Welcome, friends. This is Economic Update, a weekly program of analysis of the economic events and processes of our lives. Jobs, incomes, debts, prices, interest rates, all of that. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my adult life at several American universities. I currently teach in the New School University in New York City. I also write columns for a variety of publications, including Truthout, a remarkable and independent source of news and analysis every day. Check them out at truthout.org. If this program, and indeed all of our programs, are interesting to you, if you'd like to pursue links connected to them, interviews, all kinds of material, articles I write, please know that we maintain two websites available to you 24/7 and at no charge. The first one is rdwolf, with two Fs, .com, and the second one is democracyatwork.info. Please know that you can go to these websites, use what they have, but you can also use them to communicate to us, to tell us what you like and don't like about the program, questions you'd like us to answer, material you'd like us to consider, and so on. It's a way for you to help us, but also to participate in making this program as useful as possible to its listeners. And the other thing you can do is follow us. Click on the icon, and through either website, you can follow us on Facebook, on Twitter, and on Pinterest. Okay, before we turn to our normal updates, I want to tell you about an annual conference that happens usually in New York City and usually in the spring. It's called the Left Forum. It's the largest gathering in the United States of left-wing, if you want to call them that, clumsy kind of word, but we use it. Activists and academics sharing their experiences, what they've figured out, their ideas, their projects for the future. It's an extraordinary event bringing thousands of people together, not only from across the United States, but from around the world. And because it's so unusual and because it's an opportunity to get the kind of critical approach to things, the kind of notion of change we need, which we do on this program, I thought you might be interested in meeting the conference coordinator and having him say a few words about what the goals and the nature of this conference is. So please help me welcome Seth Adler today. Let's shake hands. And Seth, tell us a little bit from your perspective as the conference coordinator, what the Left Forum for 2014 will be, and start by telling us exactly when it will be and where it will be and all of that.
Sure. Thanks, Rick, for having me here. The Left Forum is happening this May, June, at the end of May, May 30th through June 1st at John Jay College on 59th by Columbus Circle. It's a gathering that is now in its 10th year. And as you've indicated, it's that left sort of spectrum, progressive, radical, liberals, get together, dialogue, and engage. And it's 4,000 to 5,000 strong people, including 1,200 speakers this year. There will be 400 panels and events that span from the Friday afternoon when it opens at 2 o'clock all the way through Sunday evening at about 8:30 when it ends. And as you know, because you're one of the regular presenters at the conference, it engages thousands of people in that type of dialogue that you cover here and beyond in almost every subject imaginable that the creative, critical, radical mind can engage.
Tell us some of the mainline speakers that are featured at this year. I know you always bring together some people that are plenary speakers that speak to large groups as well as then the smaller panels. But before we talk about the panels, tell us who some of the leading lights are, if you like, of people who will be there and present their work and their thinking.
This year, some of the featured speakers are Harry Belafonte, Angela Davis, Amy Goodman, City Councilor from Seattle, Sharma Sawant, Cornel West, Laura Flanders, yours truly, Stanley Aronowitz, on the international scene, Bernd Riesinger from Die Linke in Germany, Chris Hedges, and 1,200 others.
Okay, and tell us something about the panels that where you get three or four activists and or scholars together to focus on a topic. Give it just a flavor of the kinds of things, the areas that will be covered.
Well, it's, you know, there with 400 panels and workshops, the first thing that Left Forum does is divides them by topic areas. So you think of environment, social movements, race, the military-industrial complex, gender and sexuality, and on, science and technology. In all of these areas, people prepare for a year or more to do these presentations. And specific panels and workshops every year are often organized in tracks. So we'll have something that, again, you're involved in, European Left Perspective, Struggles on Austerity and Capitalism, which engages the European and the U.S. and the international concerns around these issues. Multiply that times hundreds of events, artistic events, film showings, and so forth, and you've got that milieu, which is as fun to be in the halls and in the outdoors areas of this beautiful convention and conference center as it is to be in the audience participation forms of workshops and panels that go on throughout the 3 days.
Okay, to conclude, tell the listeners and viewers where they can go to find out everything they might want to know about how to register for the conference, the details of how to get there, the directions, and eventually I assume you will be posting the panels themselves, who's on them, what they're devoted to, so that folks can make the decision about coming and participating in New York City on that weekend and make that decision based on really knowing what's going to happen.
Left Forum's open to the general public, and you can find out how to register or participate in workshops and other forms by going to the website. It's www.leftforum.org, leftforum, one word, .org. And there's also participation forms. One can volunteer and take a shift and get in free. The registration is always phenomenally low, literally in the dollars for people, in order to have it as a convergent. Now, where it's being held for these 3 days and the timing of the registration, if people want to register on site rather than on the website, rather than going to leftforum.org, you come to John Jay College.
And the directions, that's on the website too.
Right. Essentially, Columbus Circle, all of the trains, really the 1, the D, go to Columbus Circle. You walk 2 blocks down to the brand new building of John Jay on 59th and 10th. And there you'll see at 2 o'clock on Friday, the registration tables, and also on 8 o'clock in the morning, 8 to 10 on Saturday, and 8 to 10 on Sunday. We encourage folks to come out for the whole experience because it's like nothing I think folks will see, uniquely as it is with other thousands coming.
Very good. Thank you very much, Seth. And, of course, I wish you and myself, since I'll be participating, as good or better a Left Forum this year as in all the preceding 10.
Thanks, Rick, and I'll see you there.
Okay, so let's turn now to our updates, having had that brief discussion about the Left Forum for 2014. I want to begin today by remarking on something that has been of enormous interest in the media for some weeks now. This has to do with the pressure, technically these are called sanctions, that have been applied by the Obama administration to the government of Vladimir Putin in Russia. This has to do with the dispute over the Crimea, the actions of Russia in moving to make an arrangement with at least part of the Crimea, having taken over the area that goes into the Black Sea there, and so forth. What strikes me as interesting, putting aside the politics, which is not what this program deals with, are the economics. And the sanctions involved something remarkable. And here I'm using an article from the Bloomberg Business Week website, dated April 28th by Carol Matlack. It's called, the title is revealing, Why the U.S. is Targeting the Business Empire of a Putin Ally, Gennady Timchenko. Here's what struck me. the United States was able to identify the key advisors to Mr. Putin. They were able then to track their bank accounts, their stock holdings, not only inside Russia, but also outside in various European countries and beyond. In other words, they are attacking the financial holdings of the allies and advisors to a foreign politician. Now, let's look at that. One, none of these people have been convicted in any jury of any crime whatsoever. This invasion of their privacy and of their financial dealings is therefore a remarkable act. Number two, it shows that the United States government is able, when it wants to, and very quickly, to track down the holdings of high-level politicians in another country that have been carefully and systematically squirreled away and hidden in a foreign bank or other financial intermediary. The reason I want you to keep this in mind and why I'm taking time to go over it now should be obvious. How many times have we heard politicians in this country either claim that there's no way to know how to prosecute wealthy Americans who hide money around the world, illegally avoiding taxes, illegally avoiding reporting obligations, engaging in illegal economic activities? How often have we heard it say, well, you just don't know, or we can't invade privacy of people? How remarkable. Please remember with me, the next time we hear that you can't do something because the people you're trying to control can hide and evade. Indeed, I remember last week telling you that one of the reasons the Obama administration says it will not support a Tobin tax, otherwise known as a financial transactions tax, a sales tax on buying and selling stocks and bonds. One of the reasons the Obama administration gives is, it'll be hard to track down the people who try to evade this. Really? Seems to be no difficulty tracking down the advisors to Mr. Putin in Russia. Why is it so difficult to track down the wealthy in America when they do clearly illegal acts? Number two, for today, there's been a report, very, very interesting report, done by the Luxembourg Income Study, a world-famous research effort in Europe to keep track of how the incomes of different countries rise or fall in relationship to one another. And on the 22nd of April, the New York Times, to their credit, since I'm critical of them, they deserve credit too, the New York Times carried a good story about that. And here's what struck the interest of the New York Times and mine as well. How has the new century shaped up the incomes of Americans as opposed to a number of other countries? And I thought you would be struck. What the LIS, the Luxembourg Income Study, what it studied was what is called median disposable income. Let me make sure you all know what that is. Median means that level of income where 50% of the people in the country make more and 50% make less. The median is that kind of midpoint. Disposable income is a little more complicated. Disposable income measures how much you earn from your work, less how much you get in government help, typically if you're in the poorer part of the society, and how much of your income do you lose for paying taxes. In other words, what's your disposable income? Ordinary income plus government transfers minus the taxes you pay. And this study measured how that changed in the first decade of the 21st century, from 2000 to 2010. So now let me report to you. How did the United States fare? what happened to the median disposable income, the level of income after you subtract taxes and adding for whatever government help you get. In the United States, the median, the midpoint, rose by 0.3%. In other words, virtually nothing. The median disposable income in the United States didn't rise at all. In Spain, a country ravaged by the current global crisis, it rose 4.1%, many times faster than the United States. In Italy, also ravaged, 7.8%. My goodness. In the Netherlands, 13.9%. In Canada, 19.7%. And in Finland, 28.6%. In all those countries, median income rose much faster in the first 10 years of this century than it did in the United States. The United States, by all of these measures, in fact, by all measures other than the wealth of the top 1%, is falling behind more and more countries year after year. Indeed, this might help explain something many news outlets talked about over the last couple weeks, which is a number that seems to agitate Americans, that the Canadian middle class now has a higher standard of living than the American. And that's mainly because in Canada, incomes have risen slowly but steadily, whereas in the last 12 years or so, they've gone absolutely nowhere for most Americans. Okay. I want now to turn to one of our more major topics, even though it isn't a long one, it is one that deserves some extended comment. Okay. The Bank of America is the source of this story. On the 28th of April, last month, the Bank of America made an astonishing announcement. It had made an error in its accounting of $4 billion, with a B, $4 billion. It had announced that it had more capital, that's the wealth of the bank, really in the end what stands behind all of its obligations to borrowers, to depositors, and so on. It had announced a capital that was $4 billion more than what it actually had. Wow. This is a bank which has now shown itself not only too big to fail, but too big to function, is not working. One of the first things a bank is supposed to do is keep accurate records of all the people's money and all the businesses' money and all the things that are done with them day by day. That's a central function of the bank. This isn't some slip. This is a catastrophic failure of a basic function. But that's only the beginning. It turns out that this mistake was made by the auditors. That's a group of technical people inside the bank. But they weren't the only ones that were involved. It turns out that the board of directors of the Bank of America has an audit committee. That's a subgroup of the board of directors whose job it is to look at, to control, to inspect, to double-check the work of the auditors. They didn't find the mistake. By the way, this mistake has been there for years. It's not clear how many, but for years is in all the stories. We're still not done. It turns out that not only did the Board of Directors Audit Committee find nothing wrong with what they now admit was a $4 billion error, but the external auditor, that's a company separate from Bank of America, one of the leading auditing companies in the United States, the name is PricewaterhouseCoopers. It's actually the coming together of what were separate large auditing companies into one of the giants of the auditing profession in this country. Thousands of corporations in the United States use PricewaterhouseCoopers. They're an external auditor. Their job is to be outside of the Bank of America Corporation, coming in from the outside to double-check that both the auditors and the audit committee of the board of directors did their job. Yep, you guessed it. Pricewaterhouse didn't find the error either. All right, folks, let's stop playing games here. Multiple-year mistake. A mistake that allowed Bank of America, at times when it was considered questionable whether it would survive, to keep telling the public it had billions more backing up its activities than it actually had. If that doesn't raise your suspicions, I don't know what does. And now it turns out that the auditors and the audit committee of the board and the external PricewaterhouseCoopers accountants all missed this colossal error. This level of multiple failure is a sign, as if we needed it, that private monster banks are unreliable custodians of the credit and financial resources of a mature modern capitalist economy. This level of failure, coming on top of all the other failures at Bank of America, but also at Citibank and Wells Fargo and all the other large ones, long ago would have made a reasonably rational society, not governed by the interests it ought to supervise, it ought to have engendered a national debate about whether we shouldn't nationalize, socialize banking. It's too important for the economy we live in. It played too big a role in bringing on the current crisis. Its malfunction, its failure, its mistakes are grotesque, repeated, and enormous. What more is necessary to make, finally, the debate in the United States over state banking? A government bank, subject not only to the oversight of the people and the press, but also made subject to the oversight of the active participation of all of its employees, so that they can catch mistakes earlier, that they have a way to report those, and to make sure that a few people can't get together. A few auditors, maybe, and a few members of an audit committee, maybe, and a few external auditors, maybe, and all somehow miss the big problems. I don't think if you had a cooperative bank owned and operated by the government that you could get away with anything like this the way they have. Okay. Let me turn next to another case that caught my attention. In 2013, the Federal Reserve and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency issued criticisms of some of our large banks. The criticism was it was taking too long to compensate borrowers who had been abused by improper modification of mortgage loans. Here's what this means. It was taking too long. The banks were just dragging their feet in compensating people whom they had not properly treated when it came time to modifying their mortgages so they could hold on to their homes. It was taking too long, and so the Federal Reserve and the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency said, you don't have to go through some of these independent foreclosure reviews to check on your record keeping. That will make things go faster. What a mistake. What a mistake. It now turns out, again, the New York Times, April 29th, that by not requiring independent foreclosure reviews, there's been a gross underestimate of how much money was inappropriately held back by the banks, so that the settlement reached with the banks, a $10 billion settlement earlier this year, is now reached with 15 major banks, is now clearly in the minds of the New York Times, which writes this story, was a settlement far too small, letting these banks off the hook. It's sad to watch. You get the misbehavior of the banks leading the government to say, okay, here's a way to speed it up. And now that becomes a way for the same banks to get out of compensating people for the burdens they put on them. It is, again, way too much, long overdue, that the people of the United States are better served by the banks they need than what these private for-profit corporations have been doing and getting away with. It is nothing short of a national scandal, and it should long ago have been put out of its misery with a change that literally belongs in the history books of this country. I want to turn next to another shorter piece, but one that deserves, I think, a lot of attention. It has to do with the so-called recovery that we have heard so much about. Last week, I brought to your attention that the economic growth in the first quarter of 2014 was virtually zero. And this was a time when there were probably more stories about economic recovery than any of you care to remember. Recovery was in the newspaper, it just wasn't in the actual economy. Well, I did some more research on the recovery and discovered that one of the ways people convince themselves that there's been a recovery has been to notice that unemployment is going down. Well, it's true, unemployment is going down, but the minute you look a little more closely at the numbers, you learn two things. Some of commentators have found these, but others of them are slow to do so. The first one, which is relatively more often recognized, is that part of the reason the unemployment is going down is that people who used to be looking for a job and were therefore counted as unemployed have given up and stopped looking, and when that happens, they're not counted as unemployed anymore. And therefore, the percentage of people unemployed out of the total labor force goes down, not because those people got a job, but because they stopped looking. But I want to direct your attention to another way to see that the recovery is much more mirage than reality. And here I'm going to use an article from the New York Times that was remarkable, and I believe was taken from the 28th or the 29th of April. And it is, a measure from the National Employment Law Project, and you can trace them on the internet, and you can get the original data if you're interested. National Employment Law Project. It looked at the jobs gained between January 8th and February of 2010, January 2008 to February 2010, and the jobs gained after that from 2010 to 2014. And here's what it looked like. It starts with lower wage jobs. Jobs in the range of $9.40 to $13.30 an hour. During the time of job loss, when unemployment soared, the jobs lost in that low category were 2 million. 2 million jobs lost at low wages. In the period from 2010 to 2014, when jobs were being gained, when unemployment was going down, 4 million jobs in that low category were gained. In other words, 2 million low-income people lost their jobs, but when jobs came back, 4 million people got low-income jobs. When you look at middle and higher-wage jobs, you get exactly the opposite, and very dramatic. Mid-wage jobs, that's $13 to $20 an hour, and higher-wage jobs, $20 to $32 an hour, the number of jobs lost between 2008 and 2010 was nearly 7 million. And the number of jobs gained in the middle and higher wage was under 5 million. So there you have it. Yes, unemployment has gone down. But what we don't see if we focus only on that is that higher paid, better jobs were lost in much greater proportion than they were regained when we got jobs again. Whereas low income jobs, less of them were lost, but more of them were gained. In short, people at higher wage jobs have had to settle for lower wage jobs, which takes away most of the benefit that people might presume comes from a lower unemployment rate. Okay, folks, we're halfway through our program for today. We're going to take a short break. This is Richard Wolff, an economic update. I will be back very soon.
I feel tired, awake all night, head so heavy like a whisper skip. I feel choked, emotionally broke, in the gut around, I'm still looking down, I feel alone. I want out, I want on my own, I want everything I own. I find letters, pictures, memories of what you can't see to let go. In your bedside table, in your pocket, in your wallet, you know.
Welcome back. This is Richard Wolff for the second half of today's Economic Update program. Please let me remind you that if this program is interesting, if you would like, for example, to look at back programs, we have an archive of all of our programs going back the 3 years that we have been producing this program. All of these things and much more are available at our two constantly updated websites, rdwolff.com and democracyatwork.info. They are available to you, and also those are the ways you can communicate to us, send us questions, comments, and criticisms, and also follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Pinterest. I want to talk to you today about an interesting movement in Europe that you probably did not hear about. A movement that suggests that the worker co-op, as an alternative way of organizing an enterprise that isn't capitalist in the sense of a shareholders, few major shareholders who own most of the shares, who elect a board of directors that makes all the decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Instead of that kind of enterprise, a worker co-op is democratically won. All the workers in the enterprise decide all the basic questions. The workers, in effect, have become their own collective democratic board of directors. There are no shareholders. In most cases, the workers are owners as well as those who run the enterprise. Every worker in a co-op not only has his or her particular task, but is required to participate in a democratic running of the enterprise so that collectively the workers together decide, one person, one vote, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits. Well, you might be interested to know that I've been watching the performance of co-ops in Europe as they weather this economic crisis. Clearly a crisis of capitalism, global in its dimensions. But how has it worked with co-ops? Well, first thing is, since co-ops participate in a larger capitalist economy, they cannot remain unaffected by it. If people don't have the money to buy, they don't have the money to buy the products of co-ops, just like they don't have the money to buy the products of capitalist enterprises. Everybody suffers so long as you allow the major part of your economy to be capitalist and to be subject to the ways that capitalism works. But nonetheless, I want to bring two facts to your attention. The first has to do with the Mondragon Corporation in Spain. I've talked with you about that before. The Mondragon Corporation is one of the most successful of worker co-ops in the world today. Begun in the 1950s in the northern part of Spain, the Basque country. Begun, by the way, by a Roman Catholic priest, Father Arizmendi, with six workers. Arizmendi is famous for having said to his parish in northern Spain, If we wait for capitalist employers to come here to provide us with jobs, we'll all die of old age before that happens. And so to avoid that disaster, why don't we create our own jobs? Why don't we start a cooperative enterprise where we're not only the job receivers, we're the job creators? And they did it. And here we are, 60-odd years later, and what have we got? We've got the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation, actually a family of between 250 and 300 co-ops under one corporate umbrella, each of them working the way I described, with the workers collectively making the decisions. And we're now talking about the seventh largest corporation in Spain, a total number of workers over 100,000. This has been 60 years of economic growth, outcompeting other capitalist enterprises, doing a better job of producing quality output at a lower price than those capitalist enterprises were able to do, and thereby prevailing in the competition, and that's how it grew, et cetera, et cetera. Well, when the crisis hit in Europe, it was in part a housing crisis, as indeed it was in the United States. And one of the major companies inside the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation was called Fagor, F-A-G-O-R, Electrodomesticos. Okay, this was a company, I visited them in Mondragon, Spain, a couple years ago. This was a company that produced refrigerators, washing machines, that kind of a large appliances. And so if housing is in a disaster, nobody's building any houses in Europe, then they're not buying large numbers of appliances to install in these houses. So this company saw a drastic fall off in its market, in the demand for its products. But the commitment of a co-op is first and foremost not to the bottom line of profit, but to the bottom line of secure jobs for the workers. That's what a workers' co-op does. It has a different objective. It has a different set of priorities. And so I was struck by the announcement that the Mondragon Corporation has now found relocations for 937. That amounts to two-thirds of the workers who could no longer work making appliances because they couldn't sell the appliances. They found places for them in various other parts of the Mondragon Corporation or provided them with an early retirement package. They took care of their workers. They did not do what a capitalist enterprise does, announce on a Friday that there's no need for the worker to come back on Monday because his or her job is gone. And now it's up to you to go and be miserable, become desperate, go to some anonymous government office and hope they give you a check for a while, for less money, and without being too badly humiliated. None of that happened to them. They never lost their income. The company immediately went to work to find them another job in the co-op, education to get another job in the co-op, early retirement, and so on. A wonderful study in how a worker co-op reacts differently to a capitalist crisis than the capitalist enterprises themselves do. And the other story about co-ops in the crisis comes from Spain. That in the year 2013, there was an increase of worker cooperatives by a whopping 32%. And here's the explanation in Spain. They have a tradition of worker co-ops, and they have an enormous unemployment problem of people thrown out of their jobs in conventional capitalist corporations. So what's interesting, and what I want to bring to your attention, is that in Spain, because of the culture of support, of the idea of worker co-op much more developed and appreciated there than, say, in the United States, significant numbers of unemployed people, unemployed from the capitalist sector, have decided their best chances for the future lie in forming new cooperative enterprises, trying to build a better future for themselves in a corporation, in an enterprise that they are not only working in, but are themselves part of the ownership and directorship of. It's a very creative response to a failing of capitalism to produce this kind of irrational unemployment. It's the ability of working people to see the failure of capitalism for what it is and to make the decision not to go on the dole from the government if they don't have to, not to turn inward and feel bad about themselves, not to punish their families by their own loss of self-esteem, but rather to get together with other similarly unemployed people to form new cooperative enterprises. And they're doing that more carefully and more consistently and at a greater rate in Spain than anywhere else. And I thought it worthwhile to bring it to your attention. Final point on this. Yes, I say the irrationality of capitalist unemployment. Let's review why I say that. Because it's the central critique of capitalist unemployment. In the United States today, and I simply take that as an example, we have, according to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, roughly 20 million people in America who are either unemployed and looking for work, who have been unemployed and stopped looking, and who have a part-time job because they can't find what they want, which is a full-time job. So you add together the not working and looking, those who gave up looking, and those in an involuntary part-time job, you're talking 20 million people. At the same time, the Federal Reserve of the United States keeps and reports a statistic. It's called the capacity utilization rate. What proportion of the tools, equipment, factory, office, and store space that is available to us is actually being used, and what portion is sitting idle? And as I like to say, gathering rust and dust. And the report of the Federal Reserve these days is that approximately 20% of our capacity to produce is sitting idle. Okay, now let's do a really simple economic exercise. 20 million people who want work. 20% of the tools, equipment, raw materials, factory and office buildings sitting, doing nothing, deteriorating. Those 20 million people could work with all of that idle tools, equipment, and raw materials. And if they did, they would produce an output additional to what we have as a nation today of $1 to $2 trillion a year, more than enough to rebuild our collapsed cities, to solve our problems of poverty, to do an immense array of things, not to speak of the well-being of those 20 million people who now will be able to have the pride, the sense of achievement, the sense of citizenship that comes from having a decent job and earning some decent pay for it. A capitalist system that has 20 million people and 20% of its productive capacity, unable to put them together, therefore unable to realize the $1 to $2 trillion worth of wealth this country needs to solve its problems, that's an economic system that is not long for this world. That's a failure. That's an irrational economic system. And only irrational people hold on to a system that works that poorly. All right, we have come to the time in our program when I want to turn and deal with questions that you have sent in. And I'm going to deal with a couple. First, a simple question because it's basically asking me to explain something that's going on, and I want to do that. The question is reverse mortgage. What exactly is it, and what does it mean that it is becoming popular? And the person who wrote in this question added that her parents have recently taken one out, she comments, and they're not so eager to discuss it. And she's wondering why that might be. Now, far be it from me to cause difficulties in any family. I'll give you an honest answer. What you do with it is your decision and your business. A reverse mortgage. Here's what it is. It's a new kind of mortgage. Normally, a mortgage is a loan taken out by people who want to buy a home. a house, a co-op apartment, a condominium, whatever it is. You don't have enough money. Most people don't. So in order to buy a home, you go to a bank and it gives you the loan you need to buy the home. Typically, you put down a down payment, a portion, and the rest is lent to you by the bank, and that's how you buy the home. So what's a reverse mortgage? Well, a reverse mortgage is something that is only legal for older people in America. I don't know what the cutoff age is, but I would guess it's in the neighborhood of 60 years of age, more or less. And here's what you do. You have a house. Presumably, you paid off the mortgage years ago when you first got the house, maybe when you were in your 20s or 30s or something like that. And then you paid off that debt, that mortgage debt. And so the house is now yours. It's been yours for the last, say, 5, 10, 20 years. But you're an older American, and therefore you're facing increasingly the problem of how to live in your retirement if you stop working. Or even how to live with a old person's job, which is often in this society, pays very little. Think of a greeter at Walmart who gets paid almost nothing. Elderly people have been discovering in America, particularly in recent years, that their pensions are much slower than what they need to have a decent retirement. That their pensions are being reduced. That Social Security's benefits are much lower than what most people need to live, and that therefore their budgets, to say it simply, are being badly pinched. Aha, badly pinched. What are they to do? Well, for many older people, one of the few options they have is to go back to work. But being an economy with lots of unemployment, employers have their pick of many younger people, and they're only going to hire an older person if the older person makes it worth their while by accepting lower wages than a younger person can afford to do, particularly if the younger person has a family, children, and so on. And so the older people are looking at jobs which don't pay very much. Plus, they have the problems of elderly people in the way of medical issues and so on. So what's the other option? Well, they can turn to their children and ask their children to help them. The problem is we live in an economy in crisis, and younger people are having a whole bevy of problems of their own economic problems. They're discovering that their wages aren't going up. They've reached about the limits of what they can borrow. They're in the worst position in decades to help out their own parents, and the parents know that. So they don't want to take a poorly paying job that's exhausting, and they don't want to be a burden on their children at a time when it's particularly difficult for their children. Enter the reverse mortgage. It's the peculiar way capitalism responds to the crisis it has put old and young people into in an economy like the United States. Here's how it works. The bank comes to you and says, we're going to give you a loan. But it's not a loan to buy a house. You already have a house. Here's what it is. It's a loan. We're going to send you money every month. And you can use it to supplement your inadequate income. Your inadequate income from Social Security, your inadequate income from a pension, your inadequate income from whatever savings you manage to accumulate. You're not having enough. That's why you come to us, and we're going to send you $200, $500, $1,000, $2,000 a month. Wonderful, say the old people. Solves our problem. Just a second, says the banker. We're lending it to you. You're not going to have to pay it back, and you don't have to pay back interest either. Instead of you paying us back for the loan we give you every month, instead of you paying interest to us on the loan we give you every month, we're going to take a bigger and bigger piece of your house. In other words, the bank pays itself back for the loan money they send you by every month taking a bigger piece of your house. How big a piece? Enough to pay back what they lend you plus the interest they charge you for lending you that money. In effect, You're paying back as you borrow, but your payback takes the form of giving the bank an ever larger piece of your house. Now here comes the kicker. When finally you pass on, your children may have been thinking, especially if you never told them about the reverse mortgage, your children may have been thinking that one of the compensations for losing you as a parent is that they're going to inherit the house. Maybe they can move in themselves. If there are multiple children, maybe they can sell the house and give each other much-needed help in these hard economic times. Many a family doesn't discover until the meeting with the lawyer after the parent or parents die that they will be inheriting nothing, that the entire value of the house now belongs to the bank because it takes the whole value of the house to pay the bank off for the loans it made to your parents in the final years of their life. In short, the economic crisis is a silent destroyer of a middle class in yet another way. By depriving the middle class of the accumulated savings embodied in their homes, it's very easy to show statistically that most Americans have no real property. That if an American has property, the overwhelming major part of that property is his or her home. What reverse mortgages do is to say, this generation is going to eat up what wealth it accumulated in its home so that the next generation begins with nothing or next to nothing. It is the silent eliminator of the capacity for a middle class to pass on its middle class status to its children. And it will have reverberations in our society and our culture for years to come. Okay, I want in the final moments of today's program to answer another question that you sent in and that I found remarkable as a way of getting into material that I don't often have a chance to deal with. One of you wrote to me and said, I read in the newspaper that the dollar store, in fact, it's called the Family Dollar Store, is slashing stores around the country. Is this true? And what does it mean? Well, I checked into it and I discovered, yes, during the month of April, the Family Dollar Store, a discount chain that I'm sure many of you are familiar with, announced plans to close 370 stores. That amounts to 5% of all of its locations, and it is going to slash an unspecified number of jobs as it aims to boost its sales and profit. It also said it will cut prices on 1,000 items in its stores and sharply reduce the building of new stores. Wow. Family Dollar, I asked, why are you doing this? And since I can't get a straight answer from the company, or if I got an answer, I wouldn't assume it was straight, I had to go and look around. First, I discovered that competitors of Family Dollar, competitors with names like Dollar General and Dollar Tree, have done a little bit better, but are also facing troubles. Family Dollar also reported lower earnings, lower profits. It's worried about competition from Walmart and so on and so on. But I want to draw a lesson from this to make sure that lesson is clearly in your minds as it ought to be, an economics lesson, if you like. If you don't raise the wages of people at the minimum, $7.25, you make it impossible for them to go to the store and buy as much as they could if you raise their wage. If you render millions of people unemployed, they can't buy the way they used to. The casualty of the Family Dollar stores, closing 370 stores and laying off thousands, That's a consequence of unemployment and a consequence of not having enough wages for those who are employed to buy the stuff in those stores. And so you see how this feeds on itself. Because we have unemployed who can't go to the Family Dollar store, because we have low-wage workers whose wages don't allow them to go to that store very often and buy very much, we force, that's what this story tells us, we force this store to make the problem worse by closing stores and making more people unemployed and pushing more people into the position where they can go to the next store and buy. One of the peculiarities of capitalism as a system is this tendency to have problems that create more of themselves, like a snowball effect. One of the reasons you want to intervene early when capitalism has a downturn, precisely what we did not do this time, by doing something to stop unemployment, is to stop this snowball from happening. To stop the kind of story about the Family Dollar store that we're reading, a story that is undercutting the so-called recovery, not helping it. One of the reasons we ought to have thought about public employment the way Roosevelt did in the 1930s, government jobs, was precisely to keep people working, keep people earning, so they could go to the Family Dollar store and not create a situation where they're adding to the unemployment. But that would require the kinds of creative and critical thinking that is in such terribly short supply in this country, dominated as it is by those at the top who don't want to hear about or deal with anything that might cost them money, might require them to pay the taxes to hire public employees. That's, after all, how Roosevelt did it in the 30s, and that's how he would have to do it again, except that we are silenced. Neither Bush nor Obama even discusses a public employment program, let alone putting it before the people of this country to debate. We've come to the end of another hour. Thank you very much for your attention, and I look forward to speaking with you again on Economic Update next week. Change. Things will change.